Archives podcast series, The Battle of Flodden, presented by Dr. Sean Cunningham.
This is just going to be a fairly general narrative walkthrough, some of the records that we have, but also the story of the battle, which was fought 500 years ago this week on the 9th of September, 1513. So when the teenage King Henry VIII took England into the Holy League of Cambrai against France, alongside Spain, the Papal States and Venice in 1511, he was partly motivated by the history of English military achievements in the successful wars of conquest of Edward III and Henry V. A strong diplomatic role for England and the prospect of reviving the Hundred Years' War to recover Plantagenet lands in France were also important factors for a king eager to make his mark among European rulers. Henry was also asserting the energy and ambition of his personal rule, in contrast to the repressive regime of his father, Henry VII. And nothing motivated the late medieval English nation more, nor galvanised it behind its king, than the prospect of a spectacular invasion of France. A more aggressive England also put the Scots on high alert. The Scots had been steady allies of France since the Wars of Independence from England at the end of the 13th century. When the policies of both nations coincided against the English, this old alliance was revived for mutual benefit. Yet the prospects for Anglo-Scottish peace had looked good at Henry VIII's accession in 1509. The two nations had enjoyed over a decade of relative calm following large-scale raids and an abortive war in the 1490s. James IV was a king also with high ambition for himself and for his nation, and his political judgment was sometimes clouded by his need to be taken seriously as a credible European prince. His promotion of the pretender to the English crown, Perkin Warbeck, against the first Tudor King of England in 1496-7, prompted the assembly of the largest English army set against the Scots since Edward I's time. At up to 30,000 men, this was a force for invasion and possible occupation, but it never came to battle. A tax rebellion in the southwest of England split the English army and changed Henry VII's plans. The smaller force under Thomas Howard, Earl of Surrey, that did invade Scotland from Berwick in August 1497 could not bring James to battle either before the army's wages ran out and the border weather closed in. The resulting peace treaty and marriage alliance, matching King Henry's sister Margaret with King James himself in 1502, meant that England and Scotland should have had a more stable platform from which to build a long-term peaceful relationship. And this worked well until Henry VII's death in 1509. But English restraint rapidly changed once a vibrant young king stepped out from his father's shadow in April 1509. The baggage of over two centuries of warfare and cross-border violence was also hard to throw off. And despite the 1502 treaty, there were many personal issues that remained unresolved after the events of 1496-7 and the previous English invasion of 1482. In 1496 and 97, James had been humiliated. His 1496 raid had devastated North Northumberland, leaving the locals straining for revenge, and unsurprisingly, Perkin Warbeck failed totally to spark the expected northern rebellion against Henry VII. In the following year's larger Scottish invasion, James deployed his impressive and expensive array of the latest cannon ineffectively at the siege of Norham Castle. The inability of this new technology to give him an edge over Scotland's larger and wealthier neighbour compounded strategic errors that left Edinburgh vulnerable to the Earl of Surrey's English army and thousands of marine troops that had been sent into the Firth of Forth by Lord Willoughby. James was so frustrated by this that he challenged Surrey to single combat, with the town of Berwick or the king's ransom as the prizes suggested. Surrey backed down very tactfully, but there is evidence that, for the King of Scots at least, the 1513 war was unfinished business laced with a strong element of revenge. The events of 1482 had been even more ignominious. King James III's pro-English policy during the 1470s had angered his border lords. And when this policy collapsed, after marriage negotiations with the English went spectacularly wrong, he was unable to send more than a few hundred troops to the border to resist a northern English army led by Richard, Duke of Gloucester. The future Richard III was able to walk almost unopposed into Edinburgh, but found that James III had been imprisoned by his own nobles, who promptly departed the capital. Finding no one to negotiate with and the money fast running out, Gloucester called a truce and was happy to recover the town of Berwick for his brother, King Edward IV. Simply the threat of a resurgence of English military power brought into sharper relief the dormant claims to overlordship of Scotland that Edward I and Edward III especially had tried to put into practice through their Balliol candidates for the Scottish crown. Edward IV also tried this in 1482 by promoting James III's brother Alexander, Duke of Albany, as a puppet ruler subservient to England. Albany failed to inspire the coup he had promised, and an uneasy truce resulted. Memories of these events and of the civil war in Scotland that had brought James to the throne in 1488 meant that in 1513 the Scots had much to exercise and to avenge. So against this background of stuttering national warfare and diplomatic manoeuvring, cross-border reaving and raiding continued, and the wardens of the marches on both sides of the border had difficulty containing the complex, violent society of closely connected cross-border families. Their activities were more familiar to us from the better evidence surviving from the 16th century, but their presence was just as disruptive to the frontier government in the 15th century, and they did have a part to play in the Battle of Flodden. So as was the case a century earlier, when Henry V left for the Agincourt campaign, the King of England had to ensure that the back door to the realm was closed when he was away on the continent. Regional defence of the north by northerners was therefore a necessary and familiar precaution. In fact, the outbreak of national war between England and Scotland had become a rarity since the capture of King David II of Scotland at the Battle of Neville's Cross near Durham in 1346. Thereafter, major Scottish fighting was left to the border lords on both sides, primarily led by the Scottish Douglas and the English Percy families. The battles they fought, like Otterburn in 1388 or Humbleton Hill in 1402, resulted from large-scale raids. Additionally, civil wars in each nation had occurred. In England, the battles of Hexham and Hedgeley Moor in the 1460s, or Saoirseburn in Scotland in 1488, had also probably produced more regional casualties than any massive national invasion force. However, once European alliances drew most states into war, into the war being fought in Italy after 1508 that I started the talk with, it's almost inevitable that the interests of England and Scotland would collide. With things going very badly for France after the Battle of Ravenna in 1512, King Louis XII pleaded with James IV to relieve the pressure on his armies by delaying or distracting the English from their imminent invasion of France. And when Venice changed sides to join the French on the offensive in Lombardy in May 1513, James IV saw his chance to be more than a diversion. Henry VIII's attack on France in May 1513 had grown in strategic importance to the Pope's League, and James in turn perhaps hoped to change the course of European war by throwing all of Scotland's military power against the English. His intentions were sufficiently well known for him to be excommunicated by Pope Leo X in June 1513 for breaking his oath at the Treaty of Perpetual Peace of 1502. In preparation, the French king had already revived the old alliance of 1295, and he had sent French advisers and equipment into Scotland, as well as some troops. And it was their influence that led the Scots to fight in the way they did at Flodden, and that is, in the modern Renaissance style with pike squares, which had been tried and tested in the Burgundian and Italian wars on the continent. In response to this military build-up, Henry dispatched the Earl of Surrey to Berwick in the summer of 1512 with a fairly large personal retinue to boost the English garrisons on the border and to prepare the tenant armies of the Northern Lords. This is a force of about 500 men contracted to serve for a month from the 20th of August, under Surrey as the captain, with his stepbrother, John Boucher, Lord Berners, as Marshal of the Army, with about 460 archers, a small body of light cavalry, and 10 petty captains under him. And this was the basic structure of the larger army that Surrey would lead the following year. All men were kitted out in the Tudor uniform, coats of green and white, and there was a full complement of surgeons, trumpeters, messengers, sergeants-at-arms, heralds and administrators that travelled with him from Westminster to his headquarters at Pontefract. Here, Surrey established his headquarters and began to exchange information and arrange meetings with northern lords like the Earls of Northumberland and Derby. From this base, Surrey could monitor events in Scotland very closely, and in response to the start of the Scottish muster, by the beginning of July 1513, he'd arranged indentures for the supply of thousands of padded jackets and conduct money for his troops directly from the coffers of the King's Chamber. Surrey continued to keep the organisation of the campaign in the family by appointing another brother-in-law, Sir Philip Tilney, as the treasurer for war. And this is an important point, for although Surrey was familiar with the North, having served as the king's lieutenant in Yorkshire since 1487, the core of his army remained men drawn from his personal estates in Suffolk and Sussex, and they were to be his personal bodyguard on the battlefield. Surrey's relatives and close friends also took over the organisation of the English campaign. He had to be able to trust his own men once the fighting started, and to be sure that steady hands would safeguard the army's wages for as long as was needed, since the money running out is always a major factor in armies disintegrating. Even so, the resources left to defend the English border were vastly outnumbered by the Scottish army that had mustered during August 1513. The first line of English defence rested with Sir William Bulmer, the Sheriff of Durham, who led a force of about 200 mounted archers connecting the border garrisons, which also raided into Scotland. And on the 13th of August, Bulmer had already clashed with a raiding party of Alexander Lord Hume, Warden of the Scottish March. Such action might have encouraged James to more prompt invasion. Some estimates put the Scottish army as high as 60,000 men, although half that figure is probably not inaccurate. By the 22nd of August, the Scots had crossed the border and were attacking the English castles of Etal, Ford and Norham. James brought his large artillery train once more, and in about 10 days of largely unopposed fighting, he'd reduced English resistance and all but demolished Norham, which had defied him so well in 1497. Yet he did waste a lot of time before these castles, when he might have moved more swiftly to threaten Berwick or Newcastle or even Durham. And this has led some commentators to speculate that his invasion was really a grand raid designed to bring about the return of the main English force from France while satisfying James's own vanity as a chivalric military leader, fulfilling his role for his French ally. In England, the Earl of Surrey's personal retinue was paid from the 21st of July, but most of the rest of the army received wages for 14 days only from the 1st of September. James had helpfully informed Surrey and Henry of his intention to invade in a letter dated the previous month, on the weak pretext of avenging the death in 1508 of one of his marcher wardens, Sir Robert Carr. And this provides some indication of the timescale that Surrey was working under. His preparations of 1512 and his experience from the year 1497 campaign meant that the Earl knew how to muster his forces and to manoeuvre his army, how to get their weapons and provisions from Yorkshire to Newcastle and on to Alnwick, along familiar roads and with due allowance for the unpredictable summer weather, which was particularly sodden in 1513. In addition to his own retinue, the bulk of Surrey's English forces were drawn from Yorkshire, and he'd led about 4,000 men from this region in 1497, and from the Lancashire and Cheshire estates of the Stanley family. Although Thomas, 2nd Earl of Derby, was with the king in France, the vast resources of his northwestern lands and of the King's Duchy of Lancaster tenants were mobilised by his uncles, James, Bishop of Ely, and Sir Edward Stanley, the lifelong Sheriff of Lancashire. James Stanley, despite being a senior cleric, but helpfully one with a very violent reputation, brought almost 2,000 men from his own Lancashire estates. Additionally, Surrey's son Thomas Lord Howard, known as the Lord Admiral, led a marine force of about 1,100 soldiers, mariners, and Danish and Dutch gunners in 14 ships, including the Mary Rose. This fleet spent 16 days travelling from the Downs to Hull, Newcastle, and then to Berwick, from where the best cannon were unloaded and carted by the troops to their English muster and ordnance park at Alnwick Castle. Berwick also delivered up 16 brass guns, along with handguns and shot, enough to fill 18 wagons. So while Flodden was fought largely with pikes, bills and arrows, there was a considerable range of gunpowder weaponry deployed by both sides. And William Blackwall, Clerk of the Ordnance, was paid the large sum of £850 to get all of this equipment home again after the battle. So the main source for the composition of the English army, at least, which is the Earl of Surrey's own 40-page book of accounts, referred to in a lot of other records, is unfortunately lost. However, there's enough information in other surviving documents to reveal how the English intended to confront a very powerful Scottish army. Surrey's army was divided and led by 28 chief captains and 12 petty captains. And at its core were 11,500 men directly under his command. These were mainly foot soldiers, but 1,500 suits of the latest flexible body armour called Almain rivets had been sent north at the start of September. Other units such as the Marine Force, the Artillery, Logistics Train and the professional fighting crews of Berwick probably fought independently, or at least under independent command, and perhaps the Stanley Army of up to 4,000 might be considered additional numbers. And a summary of payments found in the British Library shows that wages were given for 18,699 men, making a rough total of about 20,000 men for the English Army. And it's known that the Scottish Army was at least a third larger, so 30,000 to 35,000 might be a true indication of its size. So Surrey named his chief captains in a letter to James on the 7th of September. And these men were all from Yorkshire, Durham, or the Borders, included men like Lord Dacre, Lord Clifford, Lord Lumley, Marmaduke Constable William Gascoigne, and Walter Griffith. So all these men were experienced commanders, and several had fought in border skirmishes and the last major battle in England, that at Blackheath in 1497. Interestingly, Surrey gives no prominence, on the paper at least, to the Stanley family. They had a well-known propensity for independent military action and had been involved in the conspiracies of the Wars of the Roses, and this still left them under some political suspicion in 1497 and possibly 1513. Only 7 years before Flodden, Henry VII had acted to crush their independent power in Lancashire after James Stanley, the bishop we've already heard about, was fined a huge sum for retaining a massive private army. Henry VIII and Surrey were probably nervous of affording them too much military responsibility, and Sir Edward Stanley's body of Lancashire and Cheshire archers was eventually deployed far on the English left, facing the lightly armoured Highlanders, where the arrows could have more impact. So 500 years ago, on the 9th of September 1513, national English and Scottish armies prepared for battle on the border for the first time in over a century. But unlike many previous encounters, this clash was of major importance across Europe, and news was eagerly awaited in France and Italy, as well as in London and Edinburgh. It had proved quite difficult for Surrey to get King James to agree on the place for the battle. On the 5th of September, Surrey had met Scottish heralds at Bolton by Alnwick and arranged to fight on the Millfield Plain by 9th of September, which is slightly further to the northwest. The English moved forward to Wooler, but James held the English herald prisoner so that he could not report on the Scottish redeployment onto the 600-foot-tall Flodden Edge, rather than the flatland as had been agreed. So this letter is quite a tactful admonition of James for his manoeuvre, and to compensate for this, Surrey was obliged to move his entire army around the Scots and around the hill, across the River Till, to cut off the Scottish line of retreat in case James thought of returning to Scotland without fighting, as he'd done in 1497, with his honour apparently satisfied. So even though Surrey might have headed off on an invasion of Scotland, James pretty much let him depart and stayed in position until the English reappeared from the north on the morning of the 9th of September. So James then had little time to react to this manoeuvre, and he had to move his force of thousands of men and at least 18 heavy cannon that had been dug in on Flodden Edge down the slope to the north, across the plain and back up onto Branxton Hill, which is their final position, in order to face the English front line. This was still an impregnable rise, and the Scots seemed to have burned damp straw or camp rubbish to provide a smokescreen while they relocated. And it took a long time for Surrey's army to trickle across the Twisel Bridge, where Branxton now is. And they formed up about half a mile to the north of the Scottish lines. But the terrain and the smoke perhaps prevented the Scots from seeing the full English manoeuvres and deployments, and James certainly lost the advantage of prepared positions for the guns that had probably been ranged as well. And this was a terrain that neither side had planned to fight upon, so it's worth noting some of the features that would influence the course of the battle. Branxton Village was to the rear of the English, who named the battle Branxton rather than Flodden, and Piper Hill, at 270 feet, was the high point on the English side, and that's where the memorial cross is now placed. On the eastern edge of the battlefield, There's a lot of small streams and gullies. And then the eastern side, the eastern rear, was marshland of the Palinsburn Bog, which just runs along that plantation. This is headed down towards Crookham and the River Till. And in between the two armies, at the bottom of Branxton Hills, was further boggy ground that today still retains water after heavy rainstorms. So this is where the armies actually clashed and where most of the killing was greatest. And despite enclosure and several centuries of agriculture, the land here still retains a lot of the flavour of its appearance in 1513. So it took most of the day for the English to draw up their formations. Certainly by about 4 p.m., things seemed to be ready. Lord Howard commanded the English front line and in two wings, while his father, the Earl of Surrey, held the rear line in a similar position. But once they saw the Scottish lined up on the ridge, the front of the army had to form into one solid single line. And they had to wait quite a while for the remainder of the English army to get into position to mirror the Scottish lineup. So Lord Howard urgently requested that his father close the line, since he feared the Scots might attack and use the advantage of numbers before the English were fully drawn up. And the Scottish line had five divisions. Some accounts say they were each an arrow shot apart, but that probably was several hundred yards along the hilltop. And it must have been a terrifying sight, perhaps covering a whole mile along the edge of the hill. So the right of the English line, so Edmund Howard is facing the Scottish borderers, a very imbalanced contest in terms of numbers. Then Lord Thomas Howard has the bulk of the English army, which includes many of the Yorkshiremen under Sir Marmaduke Constable, and the Scottish force was about 6,000 strong on this side. The Earl of Surrey is in the centre, facing the king, and then Sir Edward Stanley's archers are over, out of the way. It's important to have the cavalry as a mobile reserve to take advantage of the fact that both armies were on highish ground with boggy ground in the middle. It gave them some manoeuvrability depending on how the battle would go. So there are several clear contemporary accounts, including an early printed newsletter, which allows some sort of accurate reconstruction of the course of the battle. And unlike many of the English battles of the Wars of the Roses, we actually know where it was, we know who was there, and we know pretty much from the landscape how the battle must have actually unfolded. So the English knew they were at a disadvantage in terms of numbers, and the Scots had a very strong defensive position. And King James had already shown his unwillingness to come down from it, hence Surrey's manoeuvre of about 5 miles to go right round them. But now Surrey and the English found their route home blocked. So they're having to head south to get back to England. The Scots have to head north to get back to Scotland. So it basically obliges James to fight a battle. But they had to get the Scots to come down from their hilltop position and fight at its foot. And as with many late medieval battles, probably an artillery exchange started proceedings around about 4:30. So the heavy Scottish guns had not found their range before the English smaller cannons started to have some effect. And that's because the Scots were formed up in these dense pike formations. That's basically how most of the Scottish were formed up, whereas the English were mainly billmen and quite a few archers, but thousands of men dressed in half armour and padded jackets, using these pretty agricultural implements as their main stabbing, pulling, jabbing, or even slicing weapons. So the English start to cause a lot of damage to the Scots formations because they're basically standing, waiting for things to happen. You can imagine men densely packed with these 18-foot-long pikes, waiting for the opportunity to use them. And this is enough to cause some of James's troops to advance down the hill. So the first clash was on the west side of the field. Lord Hume, the Chamberlain of Scotland, and the Earl of Huntly descended to meet the Cheshireman captained by another Surrey son, Sir Edmund Howard. And I think about 3,000 men in the English line were horribly outnumbered, and there was quite a lot of casualties in this first engagement of the battle. And a lot of the men actually fled the field. And there were reports that because a lot of Cheshiremen were under Howard's command here, many had refused to fight under the Howard because the Howards had supported Richard III at the Battle of Bosworth. And there is another Stanley poem called The Scottish Field, which basically emphasises this point. So this flank of the English army was in danger of running from the field and leaving the line completely exposed. And in one source, Lord Dacre's cavalry come and block things up and hold the line. In another source, Howard actually holds on despite being knocked down three times before the line held. But after that, the battle seems to have almost come to a standstill in this sector, and Lord Hume was later executed for treason in Scotland for not specifically coming to the aid of his king on the battlefield, but basically not carrying his advantage home when he had the chance. And maybe because he is a border lord like Lord Dacre, there's some suggestion they came to an agreement as fellow borderers about not killing each other. So Scottish attention then falls on Admiral Lord Howard in the next unit along. So the Earls of Crawford, Errol and Montrose attack down the hill in their pike formations, and they set off in good order. Very solid units of pikes in expert hands, moving steadily in a wedge formation, really had dominated continental battlefields since the 1470s, mainly used by the Swiss and the Germans. And the Scots had not had too long to familiarise themselves with this weapon or the sophisticated techniques needed to make it really effective. So once the Scots reach the marshy ground at the foot of Branxton Hill, the momentum inevitably slowed, and many were apparently fighting barefoot or in their hose in order to manage the soft conditions. But this must have had an impact on the stability of their formations. The English archers and handgunners would also have done their very best to pour fire onto the advancing Scots. And a report from the Bishop of Durham, Thomas Ruthall, suggests that the Scottish armour was of such quality that very few casualties fell to English fire in this way. But the gaps did begin to appear, and the wall of spears began to lose its uniformity, and the English billmen were able to move beyond the points of the pikes and in amongst the Scottish ranks. So with two hands needed to wield this long pike, the Scots would have had few side weapons other than swords and daggers, and this left them very vulnerable to expert English billmen stabbing, cutting and pulling with this 8-foot-long English bill we saw earlier. In expert hands as it was, this was a murderous weapon, and most of the Scots casualties were probably hacked to death. And almost all the senior Scottish lords and knights that advanced down the hill were killed. And this suggests that they led from the front, which is probably true, and equally likely that the fighting was so ferocious that there was no willingness on either side to give quarter or to look for high-ranking prisoners and their ransom, as was fairly usual in late medieval battles. So while Crawford and Montrose and their thousands of troops were being cut down, further along the line, King James and the main part of the Scottish army advanced in similar fashion. In fact, all the movements described so far, with the exception of the attempt by Lord Hume to smash through Edward Howard's lines, probably took place almost simultaneously. James was perhaps aware that he only had 3 or 4 hours of daylight left before darkness once the battle had started, and this certainly would have made the fighting more confusing and dangerous. He might have thought that the flight of Edmund Howard's forces was a general retreat of the English, and perhaps heartened by this, he probably felt that his more numerous and well-equipped men could strike down the hill and sweep away the English. But it's likely that the change of Scottish position had not allowed enough time for full assessment of the battleground, or the new battleground, and the marshy conditions at the bottom of Branxton Hill were to be his undoing. Just like Richard III's ill-judged charge towards his personal enemy at Bosworth in 1485, intended to end the battle quickly by killing the leader of the opposition, so James in 1513 seems to have seized what he saw as a similar opportunity to attack directly the Earl of Surrey. Watching the English turn and run, he dismounted and pushed his way to the front of his troops and set off towards the Earl of Surrey. And it's clear that James and his troops did crash into the English ranks, and they were initially checked, but then began to push Surrey's men back. Or did Surrey withdraw? I don't know. The king was in the thick of the fighting, killing at least 10 Englishmen personally and smashing his weapons as he did so. His success brought a call for Lord Bothwell's reserves to support another assault on the English lines. Surrey might have withdrawn his men slightly in order to regroup, a tactic he'd witnessed the Earl of Oxford do against him at the Battle of Bosworth in 1485. And this move probably blunted any momentum that James had generated and left his forces on the wet ground in the dip between the two ridges. So the movement of so many men over this area, the piles of dead and wounded and their scattered equipment, must also have hindered the Scottish advance, which might even have been slightly uphill at this point. And it was then that Sir Edward Stanley's force, and they used the cover of the gullies and ditches and the steep ground on this side to rise up onto the hill and attack the Highland division from the side. And this is where the arrows really would have had a terrible effect. The English longbow had done so much damage to the French in various 14th century battles and at Agincourt. So this rain of arrows on what would have been fairly lightly armoured Highlanders must have had a devastating effect. And this had also the effect of driving the Scottish troops into the already congested central area of the battlefield. And as dusk was probably falling, the general confusion and panic must have increased enormously. And it's at this point that King James was killed, reputedly within a spear's length of the Earl of Surrey. So just like Richard III again, he almost got to his man. And of course, once James, the King of Scots, is dead, fighting would have stopped fairly quickly. Most of the accounts don't go into a lot of detail about what happens next, but we know that the English army returned to Berwick and took James's body with them. The next day, the Earl of Surrey sent a small contingent to the battlefield to get the Scottish cannon, apparently worth 1,700 marks and of great value to Henry VIII. There was a further skirmish on this day, but Surrey, who was ever mindful of his ability to pay wages and keep order in his army, did little to press home his advantage. He had been reprimanded by the English king in 1497 for overreaching his authority, acting too independently, so he probably was overcautious this time in awaiting some sort of direct instruction from the king, who unfortunately was in France, so it was going to take a while for Surrey to find out what to do next. He does seem to have strengthened the garrisons on the border, but he basically left the Scots to come to terms with their loss without putting any additional pressure on them. And the English victory made very little difference to Henry VIII's policy towards Scotland. Defence of the border with regular raiding and attempts to manage the border clans were soon renewed as normal. The Scots faced a period of minority rule and an internal struggle for influence amongst those that had escaped the massive loss of experienced men, landholders and soldiers at Flodden. Amazingly and catastrophically for Scotland, perhaps up to a third of the army were killed, never mind who were casualties. But this included 9 earls, 13 lords, 5 heirs to titles, 3 bishops, 2 abbots, and of course the king himself. Such a level of disaster for a nation's elite is unprecedented in medieval English battles, or British battles. The English losses were still considerable at about 4,000, but very few senior figures were killed. And given Scotland's long history of conflict with England, the pain of this defeat remains quite prominent within Scottish national identity, although it's somewhat shrouded, really. And it has cast a bleak and mournful aspect over a better understanding of Scotland at the start of the 16th century. Works like Sir Walter Scott's Marmion, published in 1808, reintroduced this heroic massacre to 19th century audiences. And when the battle was marked this week, it was with quiet commemoration, in contrast to what's likely to emerge for next year's 700th anniversary of the English defeat at Bannockburn. And an excellent recent survey by Katie Stevenson and Gordon Pentland of Flodden and how it has been commemorated since 1513 indicates that although the national and regional profile of the battle has waxed and waned, for the Scots and in the borders especially, it is now a very important event. And more widely, in terms of military British history, it has become a special case, which makes it almost, as they say, as Katie Stevenson has said, as an anchor for narratives surrounding war and loss, especially in the medieval and early modern periods. So the National Lottery Fund has supplied almost £900,000 to a consortium in the border to commemorate and to build an eco-museum, lots of education activities. So if anyone has been to the battlefield recently, there's obviously going to be major changes to the way the battle is interpreted and our knowledge of it. Several new books have come out to go into more depth and detail than I've been able to do here. And it's a very interesting and slightly removed and remote battle, not just because of its geographical location, but I think even for the English, the level of disaster was quite horrific and very difficult to come to terms with, because these sort of things didn't happen where you basically annihilated the entire upper class of your opponent's country. So I think had Henry VIII been there in person, we might have seen a slightly different response. But because the victory was the Earl of Surrey's, for which he was elevated to the Dukedom of Norfolk, the English couldn't really press home their advantage. If you are interested, the project being run from Berwick Record Office has got a lot of our relevant documents transcribed. A lot of volunteers are transcribing them to make online resources in the region, basically to try and explain this battle more clearly in its context, both to school children and to the interested general public.
This talk was recorded on the 12th of September 2013 at the National Archives, Kew.